so miss that music because it announces what is for me the perfect hour-long coffee break with my very, very dear friend Emma Kell, whom I have not spoken to for far too long. Emma, how are you doing?
I am all right. It's surreal, isn't it? I feel strangely tired, which is strange because, you know, I have slowed down a bit, but I feel this lethargy, which is partly just because I'm stinking roasting hot and partly that sort of Groundhog Day feeling where time has done this weird thing of both being, having gone really quickly and being really, really prolonged and slow. And one minute I think everything's normal again and I'm in a traffic jam on the North Circular. And the next minute I'm reminded of face masks and sanitizer and the fact that I can't see you, I can't see my friends. I miss, you know, that I did this one of those personality tests recently and I found that I am a massive extrovert, I was surprised. I was genuinely surprised because I do spend half my life trying to get out of social occasions. I'm not one for parties and pubs, but I do get my energy from people. And I've really realized that over the last few months. I massively miss people and I've really missed you. And you have been on epic journey. How's it been?
Do you know, I think I'm about 3 months behind everybody else. So I'm in the middle of loving being basically stuck inside, doing nothing, having absolute permission to sit with a book and lose 3 hours and not feel bad about it. So I remember when everybody else was in lockdown and I was going to school, I was thinking, God, you know, I'm so busy and everyone's talking about crocheting and journaling about how bored they are. You know, have they no idea? Whereas now I'm like, aha, I'm so bored. It's glorious. So I think it's, I'm just a few months behind everybody else, but I've enjoyed it for a few weeks, but I'm now starting to look at August stretching ahead and I'm slightly anxious about what that might look like, particularly in light of the news this morning that actually, can we really go out any more of lockdown and can we start lifting more restrictions? It looks like the answer is going to be no. So that slightly worries me.
Yeah, but have you made the most of it? Have you been to a pub?
I did go to a pub with a friend. That we're very lucky. The pubs down here are being really, really sensible. So they've got far fewer people coming in. You have to book a table in advance. It's really spread out. So it was actually quite pleasurable, although a bit strange. But then there are other parts slightly further out in Kingston where it basically feels like Glastonbury, or how I imagine Glastonbury to feel. Wow. I'm not cool enough to have been. But it just feels like really heaving and quite uncomfortable to the point where I won't even go running now of an evening if I know they're all going to be out there. So that worries me quite a lot.
I trick myself into believing everything is completely back to normal and then suddenly just have this jolt of genuine fear. We had the antibody test the other day to find out whether we'd had it or not. Haven't.
Interesting.
I know. Have you had it?
No. So I had a COVID test because I went to Jersey to see some friends. It was family, actually, not even friends, family, within, you know, the restrictions that were put in place. And one of the restrictions placed on us by Jersey is that when you land, you have to have a COVID test. So I had the old swab. It goes in your throat first, then it goes up your nose. And I'm so glad they did it in that order. Otherwise, I'd have felt like a reception child. but it was quite uncomfortable. But what then slightly surprised me was they then said, oh, go and enjoy the island and we'll be in touch with your results, which luckily I then got 2 days later to say I didn't have it. But it was very organised. But you just suddenly think, oh, my God, what if it comes back that I have got it? Not that I feel ill in any way, shape or form. It's odd. I'd love to know if I've had it, though.
Well, I was absolutely convinced I had. And I'm now having to come to terms with the fact that I was probably just a lazy bugger for the first 2 weeks of lockdown, because I was struck by this absolute exhaustion, can't get out of bed, and I had a bit of a cough and I managed to convince myself that it must be COVID, but basically it was either an emotional reaction to not being allowed to do anything, I'll just take to my bed like a Victorian lady, or I'm just terminally lazy, I don't know.
It's so interesting, and I think the more you hear about different illnesses and symptoms, the more you think you've got them, I'm sure of it. And my boss very kindly said to me at the end of last term, you know, when we break up, make sure you take some time, because you have to understand the impact that the stress and the workload that you've gone through must have had on you. But it's yet to hit, actually. I think it's taken me much longer to relax into the summer. still quite anxious, still quite finger picky. My husband keeps getting incredibly frustrated with me that I have to keep on the move. I mean, I've done every yoga class going. I've still been out running, riding, walking. But, you know, I think it's because we didn't have that obvious end of term where we had the last few days clearing down and everyone was together in a big summer party. You know, none of that really happened. So it didn't really feel like the end of term. And yet here we are away from our children.
But our producer has just nudged me to point out that actually I have not had COVID. But you know what's been really lovely, Clem, because I've really been feeling for you through all of this, because despite my whinging and finding it quite difficult, you know, we've been at home, we've been comfortable, we've been with our own kids, protecting our loved ones. You haven't been able to see your loved ones for weeks and weeks and weeks. No. And I've just loved seeing those photos popping up of you with your horses and your parents for the first time.
How has it been? Do you know, it's really interesting. I'm very good at compartmentalizing what's happening. So as soon as COVID struck and we shut the schools and everything else happened, I sort of thought, right, this is going to be a tricky time for the next few, well, I must admit, I thought the next few weeks, not next few months, which is a bit naive looking back, but just crack on. And then it soon became apparent I wasn't going to see my family. And again, I just thought, right, you're not seeing them, you know, crack on, at least you've still got them and you can still talk to them. And that sort of thing. And then came the sort of awkward, I'd almost call it negotiation of, right, well, now school's finished and I'm not around lots of children and I've had 2 weeks away from everybody to sort of get rid of all my germs and everything else. Are we in the rules? Can I come and see you? Can I hug you? What will that look like? Am I allowed to be in your house? And we sort of worked our way through it and found out the best way. But it has just been utterly, utterly joyful. And at the risk of sounding like a complete convert new age thinker, it has completely reframed how I see all the things I have in my life. In all seriousness, I'm so utterly grateful and appreciative of fresh air, of grass, of being in Hampshire, where you can walk to a point where you cannot see or hear anything or anyone apart from you and your dog, having a family that are still there, that are so utterly proud of you and what you've done, that can still take the mickey out of you and be rude to you. I just hadn't appreciated that. And I now feel awful that I hadn't appreciated it, because some people have come through this having lost some of that. And I just feel utterly, utterly blessed to still have it. And I'm just so happy. And that's why, although we're not going away and we're not doing all these things that we'd normally do in the summer, my break will be just being around people I love, because I can be again, which is just incredible.
Wonderful. Wonderful. But you just said about trying to negotiate what you can do and what you can't do.
Oh my God.
It's I've just been watching the news now, and this is the day when it's hands, face, space is the three-word mantra.
Oh, is that the new... Right, who talked to the Conservative government about three-word things? We used to talk to Year 6 in persuasive writing about the power of three, and it was very much a Key Stage 2 writing SATs thing. Write down three things that will engage your audience. Clearly, someone has said the same to number 10, because stay alert, control the virus, save lives is now what? Yeah. Face, space, trace or something?
No, hang on. Hands, face, space. Yes,
I think trace works better.
Yes, it does. Should we write in?
I think we should. It's just crazy. And do you, having watched the news, do you now understand what you can and can't do?
I don't have the first clue what I can and can't do. No, I genuinely am deeply confused. And there's a little part of me that just wants to stay inside and play it safe. I don't have a clue. And I am aware that today is also Eid, and that many of my friends were really looking forward to celebrating with their families, and that in the north of England today, that what's the phrase Boris used? He's squeezing the brakes and on the easing of lockdown, which I understand, but I can completely understand as well if I put myself into the shoes of one of my Muslim friends who are making jokes quite good naturedly about meeting their families in the pub because that's the only place they can meet. I can understand the rage, because actually, you know, the pubs opened on 3rd of July. Some people were really well behaved. My friend works in a pub and said actually it was a nightmare trying to get people to follow the one-way system, and that actually worse than children.
Drunk adults are worse than children without a shadow of a doubt.
And drinking has gone up massively since lockdown, hasn't it? Yeah. I mean, do you remember? I remember this genuine feeling of panic right near the beginning when someone phoned me specifically to tell me that they'd run out of boxed wine in Sainsbury's.
Well, Well, their instant thought was to notify you.
Crap. We've got to go out. Our essential shop, which is terrible. But yes.
It's brilliant. I think it's really hard. I mean, I know I have a lot of children in my school who are Muslim, and I know how important that togetherness is. And that's so much part of their celebration. It's that being together and being with family and just enjoying the most delicious foods that everyone's prepared together. And it really saddens me that friends in other parts of the country cannot do that. And yet I can walk down to the local Wetherspoons and get a 2-for-1 before jumping on a train and going into central London for cocktails. It just doesn't, feel right. I don't know the answer. I don't know the solution, but it just doesn't feel right. And so I suppose for me, so much of this just hasn't felt right. And as you know me well enough, and a lot of my friends would joke about, I'm a real stickler for the rules. If I'm told I can or cannot do something, I will do it to the letter. I don't know why. I wish I'd been like that as a teenager. Goodness me, I'd have achieved so much more with my life. But yeah. If you tell me I can't go out, I won't go out. If you tell me I can, I will. If you tell me what it should look like, I'll follow it. And I think most of us are quite like that, but there's just been no clarity. So people don't know. Do they wear a mask? Yeah. Don't they wear a mask? One thing I think we need some clarity on, certainly down here, is how to wear a mask.
Yes.
I like people. I think people are largely really intelligent and I sound like Michael Gove now, have common sense, but maybe they don't, because the mask needs to go over the nose and the mouth, guys. Like it's got to be an all or nothing situation. And as fun as you make them decorative and jazzy, you still need to wear them.
Rav was in Hastings the other day watching people on the beach and saying lots of people are wearing them as fashion accessories on their elbows.
Elbows or as a headscarf. Or a little chin hammock. It's all going on apart
chin
from
hammock.
Nostrils and mouth. Like, what's going on?
But it's
and
also,
there's a little bit of me that wants to say, what's going on? Like, I was sat, as I said, when I was in Jersey, we flew back and, I get the focus on the economy. I really do. I don't know whether we need to fill the plane quite that much, but, that's up to the well-known Orange airline that I was flying with. But the couple next to me, literally next to me, were wearing masks over their mouth and not their nose.
Oh,
do you say something? Don't you say something? Do you hope the air cabin crew will say something? And then they don't. And then you think, oh, I'm being that COVID judgy teacher that we talked about with Ben and Hadley all those months ago about COVID judgment. It's just a minefield.
Well, and you were fiddling with your mask, which is a no-no as well.
I did fiddle with that.
Someone did have a great analogy about treating your mask like underwear. Not sharing other people's, not fiddling with it in public and changing it when damp, which
and wearing it properly. Put them on properly. And go for a nice full pant, like a Bridget Jones pant. This isn't about style, it's about substance. You want some big old spanks that just cover the majority of your face. They're not going to move for love nor money and keep you safe. That's what we need. Maybe Spanx need to design one. That's the next thing. Or like M&S with like a full bodied one. Yes. Oh, I can see a whole thing. Sweaty Betty, my favourite running wear company, have bought out a mask and it looks really cool. And it's like 3-layer, 99.9% bacteria, can't get through it. I'm going to buy one. I'm excited.
Was it Sweaty Betty? No, it was another one of those really famous sporting brands. So fitness over lockdown. Okay, so I seem to have noticed that people have gone in one direction or the other. And I'm afraid I've gone in the other. So when I had my fake COVID at the beginning of lockdown, I stopped running. I just stopped. I languished in my own self-pity of lockdown and stopped completely. And so I've put on about as much weight as other people have lost. So I went on to one of those. It wasn't that one. It was another swanky sportswear brand where everything's supposed to be lovely. And I found out that I was an XL and I had such a strop about it that I stopped my purchase halfway through. And stomped away from the computer and tweeted something indignant about how can a size 16 be an XL? But yes, so I am very impressed with your yoga ring and your
Do you know,
still running.
I've kept it going. I've kept it going. I think it's because when you were like allowed an hour, this all seems like we're talking about a decade ago. A few months ago, you were allowed an hour outside for exercise, weren't you? And so I took that as like, this is your time to shine. This is your hour and make the bloody most of it. So I was donning my PE kit like there was no tomorrow and running and I was doing Joe Wicks with the children. And I can admit this to you, but I may end up texting Rav and asking him to edit it out later. But I was doing Joe Wicks with the Key Worker Club. And I was wearing one of those, M&S do these zip up bras, like active wear bras. It said high impact. I mean, come on, people. And it was zipped up at the front and I'm in there bouncing around and doing my burpees. And out of nowhere, the thing just springs open.
Oh,
like
man.
The gates of heaven just pew. And oh my God, all I could think was, style this out now. You're going to have to style it out. You're just going to have to deal with the situation. Now, thankfully, I was wearing a very snug top over the top of said sports bra. And so I was able to just keep bouncing, but rotated my bounce 180 degrees, got to the back of the room, quickly zipped it back up and was back in time for my lunges. But dear Lord above, that will be a residing memory of Key Worker Club and Joe Wicks. I mean, he did some great stuff for the nation, but just not for the nation's underwear, I think it's safe to say. But no, I kept going with brilliant. All of it. It was so awful. And kept going with the running, although I'm fairly confident the marathon's going to be moved to April. I really do. So I've backed off the running a little bit. I'm doing other bits.
Oh, but I think it's going to happen. But is it going to happen?
Well, the latest we've been told is that we can expect to do it in October. But I think with the news today that they're postponing any pilots for larger sporting events, what's October? 2 months away? That's just not going to happen. My hope is that they just carry our entry over to April next year. Otherwise, I think I'm just going to have to run it anyway and see what happens.
Yes, anyway. Do it. Get me off my bum. I'll do at least a kilometre and a half for you.
Yes.
As long as I can walk for 2 minutes every minute. So
I'm planning on walking.
Yes. Right. We wanted to talk about leadership, didn't we? We wanted to talk about schools and leadership and what COVID-19 and this earth-shattering pandemic means for school leadership.
Yeah, we did. And I think it's about looking, as someone once said to me, a good appraisal is like 50% looking back at what's happened and 50% projecting forwards. And I think that's what school leadership needs to be doing right now. So looking back over the last 3 months, not in terms of, oh God, all the things we lost, but actually just what can we learn? What can we take forward with us? Because this isn't going away. This is not going away. So what can leaders learn from the last 3 months? And what can leaders therefore take into the next, dare I say, 1 to 2 years? And how we can best carry our communities forward in such a way that they can still prosper, still thrive, still feel loved, nurtured, supported, and celebrated, but still do what they need to do for children, because ultimately that's who we're here for. And as such, I don't have all the answers, and nor do you. So we reached out to a very, very good friend of mine, Andy Buck. Now, as many of you may know, Andy started life as a geography teacher. He's been a head. He's been director of the National College for School Leadership. He was also managing director at United Learning, the biggest multi-academy trust in the country. But beyond all of those accolades, he has also been my leadership coach, which obviously is where he's done most of his learning and research. And we were very, very lucky to catch up with Andy just to explore the issues that heads are considering and what they need to be doing for their schools as they move into September. So sit back, enjoy, and listen to this expert on what we as leaders can and should be doing as we look towards the future.
My big passion over the last few years has been leadership and trying to codify what it is that leaders do and have a kind of, you know, I suppose if we were writing a curriculum about leadership, which is what I was doing 6 years ago, one might call it a schema or a way of thinking about how does it all fit together. And one of the models that I came across when I was doing my research, when I went freelance 6 years ago and set up Leadership Matters, was a model from the Corporate Leadership Council from, you know, 16 years old now, that basically said that what you do, your leadership, in whatever role you're in, whether you're a head or a middle leader or even a teacher leading a classroom, because I think it's just as applicable, you know, there is an impact of that on results and outcomes. And, I don't just mean exam results. I'm talking about the whole what you want for your children. But what's really interesting about this model is that there's a gap between what you do as a leader and getting those outcomes, which is not a surprise because there's a whole bunch of other people involved between you leading and, you know, because if as a head, you're not teaching every lesson. As a middle leader, you're not delivering all the curriculum. Other people are, you know, and as a teacher, the kids have got to do the work, haven't they? It's not just down to you to get the exam results or the test results or the turning out these young people who are confident and articulate and imaginative and entrepreneurial. You know, that they have to do that. So, but what it does, what this model does suggest is that one's leadership, we can say, creates two things. It creates the culture of the team, the classroom, or the organization that you're leading. And by that, it means the way we do things around here. It's what, you know, if you went and visited, it's what you typically see going on in that classroom or that school or that team. And there's something else as well, though, because quite a lot of models that talk about culture wrap this second thing up in culture. But actually, I love this model because it doesn't do that. It says it's separate and it's important because our leadership doesn't just create a culture. It also creates a climate, which is how people feel to be in your classroom as a teacher.
Yes.
How people feel to be a member of your team as a middle leader. How people feel to be in your school as a, you know, and Clemmie, you were just talking about the amazing stuff that's been going on in your school in response to all of these challenges. And it's a product of the leadership, you know, sorry to just, you know, make you blush in a podcast if that's possible, but you know you have created an extraordinary culture and climate. Yes, at least this is for a good professional reason. We've had plenty of other blushes, I think, but
haven't
anyway. But it's creating, you know, it's that combination of culture and climate that gets you what's known as how much discretionary effort you have in a team, which put bluntly is how much people do over and above what they have to do to not get fired, but much more positively is how much do people care about what they're doing and go the extra mile, you know, and I don't mean work all the hours, I just mean care about their work. And that is what's been happening at Surbiton Girls Prep School because of the leadership and the culture and climate that you've created. So I absolutely empathize with head teachers. It's a really difficult situation at the moment. There's one school of thought that says, well, I'm just going to not worry about this at all, and I'm just going to follow the government advice. Because then if something goes wrong, I can say, well, I did what you told me. But there's a bit of me that says, whilst that might be a very safe approach to adopt from the point of view of self-protection, I don't really think that's what I really would do if I was in that situation, because I don't think that's what I really did when I was ahead. I didn't always do what I was told to do or was suggested that I did.
You surprised me, Andy.
And so whilst that might be the safe thing to do, I think I probably would be saying, well, look, as long as you've thought about this, do what you think is right. I mean, I suppose my advice would be don't do anything that's potentially more risky than the government are asking you to do. But if you want to do something that you think is effectively less risky, because your analysis in your situation is that you would be very uncomfortable, then I think, you know, I would have absolute sympathy with head teachers that took that view and decided not to do. I mean, what's been absolutely fascinating, I was talking to someone today who, Ben Barton, who works at National College of Education, you probably know Ben actually, Clem, and he, you know, he's talking to a lot of heads at the moment because they're just in the process of creating the cohort for next year's National College programs, including the one that you're on. And
well worth doing, by the way, everyone.
Well
worth
great. Doing.
Just, plug there.
I didn't realise this was
maybe
a plug
not in the middle
fest,
of pandemic,
this podcast.
But pretty good.
No, I can imagine. But he was saying that, you know, in the conversations that he's been having with heads, that they have been up and down, and they are finding that emotional roller coaster. But what he was also observing is that actually central government in the last 2 or 3 weeks has just become less relevant because local decisions are now being made by groups of schools such as, you know, United Learning. And I'm kind of thinking, yeah, okay, this is absolutely fascinating. But the one thing that I think has been helpful, because I've been doing a lot of coaching of heads as well, is just trying to help people in the right way, given where they are, because there's a, again, this was something I kind of came across after I'd stopped being a head and never came across on any training, but Kubler-Ross's kind of grieving cycle has been applied to how people respond to all sorts of change, not just being bereaved. And that sense of shock through to denial, then frustration, and sometimes anger, and then you go into kind of depression, and then you start to come out the other side where you experiment a bit, then you make some decisions, and then you kind of reinvent your new world. And actually, at the beginning, all you need to be giving people is a bit of clarity and certainty. Then they just need support to work through it, and they need to be given time. And then in the end, you need to celebrate the fact they've come out the other end. And so I think for all of us, keeping that in mind, both in terms of our own, where am I on this curve, but also this person I'm talking with at the moment, thinking about, well, where are they at the moment? Are they ready for me to start try and cheer them up? Or actually at the moment, do I just need to empathize and say, yes, it must be tough, but not try yet to offer them support because they're just not ready yet for that. And, you know, it's a difficult call, but I think it's a helpful framework within which to think about some of this, actually.
I think there's a huge amount in there that we can all reflect on and take away, whether we are heads, whether we are SLT, whether we're teachers working for those heads in SLT. I think Andy's been really, really helpful there. And I think, you know, one of the big things for me with Andy is he has such integrity and honesty. He's an incredibly honest person, so much so that you may have seen his article in Schools Week where he came out and shared his sexuality with everybody, which he didn't have to do, but I got the sense that he wanted to and had almost felt at times he'd let down his children in school by having not been honest about who he was. And it reminded me of a tweet I saw a couple of days ago where there was a teacher reaching out to the Twitter community saying, has anyone got any advice for me being gay and being honest about my sexuality in school? And I instantly thought of Andy and thought, gosh, he would have so much to share on that. And I think that role, you know, sort of role model as a leader is so, so important. And I just feel utterly blessed to sort of hear from Andy and be able to develop alongside him. So much so that we actually asked him about this. So let's hear what he's got to say about it.
You know, the best teachers are the teachers that give of themselves, aren't they? And you know, I suppose it's just that difficult line of how much do you give in the end?
How much of your
yourself.
And what would you say, Andy, if you know someone was listening now who was just really wrangling with their sexuality or their gender, and just listening to everything you were saying, thinking, oh my God, that was me 5 years ago, however, you know, whatever. What advice would you give them? How would you coach them through that process?
Well, I think it's about helping. I mean, it's interesting you say, well, how would you coach them? Because I think that's what people in that situation need. They need someone to talk with who is not going to suggest what they need to do, but it's going to help them work out what's right for them. And that's the power of coaching, actually, is so often it's about, it's, I mean, both of you, I mean, it's really interesting because I'm very attuned to this now, having just written this book, the use of nuance in language. So you've both been using phrases like I'm curious about or I'm interested in. And that's just so ingrained and natural for you. You don't even know you're doing it. And I'm probably quite similar. But it's very different from saying, I think this or why did you do that? You know, I'm curious.
I think I'm just nosy.
Yeah. But there's a whole, you know, in the book, I talk about one of the basic qualities, because having a book called Basics, brilliant for the way you can use it as, you know, you've got basic steps, basic qualities, basic habits. It's all basic, but it's not. But remaining curious is one of, I think, the basic qualities. So helping, but also, you know, really caring about someone. But the other thing, though, is just keeping positive is, you know, whatever you want to do, that's fine. You know, like you were just both with me just now, you know, cutting someone some slack and saying, well, what's right for you? You know, you decide. So I think it's just, I just find someone you can talk with who's going to help you is probably the answer to that question.
The thing that really stands out for me there is Andy's bravery. And I think as school leaders, you do have to be really brave and you have to tackle things that you might find difficult or you don't quite have the right words for to talk about. And I think, Emma, you've got some interesting thoughts on this, haven't you?
So Andy's coming out and the way he talks about it reminded me an awful lot of the phrase, you cannot be what you cannot see, which has come up a number of times in the context of discussions about Black Lives Matter. And I think it's worth saying that, you know, Clemmie and I have just acknowledged that we get quite waffly when we talk about this because we are... It's a deeply uncomfortable topic. We are both white, privileged females. It is not something to which we can immediately relate. And yet, I think for both of us, the growing realization that remaining silent is a problem is is there. And so I would say I'm probably at the stage of my tentacles are up. I am aware. I am willing to challenge. I am willing to challenge injustice. And I'm acutely aware of it. So we wanted to talk about the impact of Black Lives Matter and the murder of George Floyd on our school communities. And we first of all wanted to play you a clip by a psychologist called Jane Elliott. And it's something she has used with adults and children, I believe. And let's hear what she has to say.
I want every white person in this room who would be happy to be treated as this society in general treats our citizens, our black citizens. If you, as a white person, would be happy to receive the same treatment that our black citizens do in this society, please stand. You didn't understand the directions. If you, white folks, want to be treated the way blacks are in this society, stand. Nobody's standing here. That says very plainly that you know what's happening. You know you don't want it for you. I want to know why you're so willing to accept it or to allow it to happen for others.
So having heard that clip from Jane Elliott, we now need to think as schools about how we discuss this issue with young people, because young people are completely aware of what's going on. You know, it's all over. Mm. It's all over Instagram. They know exactly what's happened with George Floyd. Most of them have seen the clip. They understand it. So how do we actually begin to open those discussions with them to make sure that all voices are included and we allow them to discuss those very uncomfortable issues, which even we as adults find very difficult? Mm. So for me, I'm just now sick of the apologism that comes from people who are claiming that this is not a racist country. And I know it's deeply uncomfortable to accept that it is, but we know, facing those children in those classrooms, that our children who are non-white are more likely to be stopped by the police. They are more likely to end up in prison. They are more likely to be stopped in a supermarket and accused of theft. Their parents are having to train them to make sure they've got receipts if they're young black boys, for example. We need to confront this in the classroom. And I wonder, you know, I mean, that clip makes us feel uncomfortable, and it should. Mm. I think discomfort is the beginning of awareness, isn't it? But it's how...
I think for me, that experiment's about getting the children to face head on what it is like to be discriminated against or to be discriminated. You know, children by their nature are not discriminatory. They are not racist. I worked in one of the most multicultural schools in Hampshire a few years ago, where in some classes, you know, white children were the ethnic minority and they were not innately racist. It just wasn't there. And yet there are certain nuances around race and discrimination and even just grouping that children just absorb and accept as part of society. And it's about getting them to open their eyes and see that that's happening. And it is blisteringly uncomfortable and difficult. And I think, you know, the reason why we get waffly about it is because we're scared of using the wrong words or offending. And children don't have that filter. They will just say it as it is. And so it's just educating them to see that there is difference, that they, if they were to walk a mile in somebody else's shoes, it would look and feel very, very different. And then again, once they've got that understanding, it's then, so what? What are you going to do about it? How are you, as the future leaders, the future teachers, the future prime minister, going to change it for the better? And that's the big, big bit to do.
Yeah. And we educate them by allowing them to see us educating ourselves, I think. I mean, the recent headlines on exclusions and the chances of being excluded being far greater as a non-white student really struck me. And I'm looking back over my career and thinking, well, was I partly responsible for excluding somebody because she kissed her teeth at me? And in retrospect, could I be asking that child, actually, well, tell me about teeth kissing. Tell me about how it fits in with the way you communicate. Tell me what it means, so that I don't, as a white woman, immediately assume that you're disrespecting me. You know, help me understand the language you're using, so that I'm not. You know, there was a great episode of Word of Mouth last week where they were talking about how they learned to speak white British male. Do you speak fluent white British male? Because in order to be understood in school, we have to be able to speak that language. So actually, for me, educating them is about allowing them to educate me. So tell me about this word. Where does this come from? You know, tell me about this music, rather than dismissing it straight away, actually engaging with them directly. I don't know what you think about how we can better educate our young people, because they're going to be looking to us.
I certainly echo the thoughts of others that it's about looking at our curriculum, both our explicit curriculum in terms of what we teach, who we explore through the curriculum, whose music we learn about, whose artwork we study, whose history we fully understand, but then also through the hidden curriculum. Do our books in the library reflect that multicultural society? Do the home corners in our infant classrooms, do they reflect the different homes around our country? You know, those sorts of things that I think you have to look at your schools with a new set of eyes and think, does this reflect where my children are coming in from in the morning and where they're going home to in the evening? Or does it reflect a sort of 1950s white British classroom, because that's what you've always had, a home corner with a little kitchen with a gingham tablecloth and nice cupboards that, you know, we've got our Saxo salt in. Actually, does that reflect what every home looks like? No, I don't think it probably does. And yet I'm pretty sure that's what most home corners do look like. I'll probably get a barrage of telling off now that no, lots of people's home corners don't look like that. But, you know, I just think it's about looking again with new eyes. Do we reflect our schools and our homes that our children come from? And I'm very comfortable in saying ours probably doesn't. And it's something that we as a school have recognised we need to do some serious work on. Yes. And in fact, I've had a lot of staff put themselves forward voluntarily to do it and lead on it, which I'm really excited by. They're the right people to do it because they're passionate about it. They're committed to it. And I know that they'll be brave enough to say to me, you're getting this wrong. There's a head. This is what we need to be doing instead. So bring it on. It'll be uncomfortable, but bring it on.
It's being open to that, isn't it? And yeah, there's one more point I wanted to make about risk assessments and our staff, thinking about staff and how we're looking after our staff. And if you are of a non-white background, you are 40% more likely to be affected by COVID. So if you haven't got a separate risk assessment for your BAME colleagues, then that really is something that you need to be talking about and confronting head on, because there's no point saying, you know, everybody matters. We've got a risk assessment for everybody. You really need to be looking at those people to make sure their voices are being heard and they're being valued. So Clem, just thinking about what you said about kids being innately non-racist, how do we then confront the parents? How do we begin to deal with some of those prejudices that are coming from home?
Oh, it's so hard, isn't it? Because, you know, it's similar to when we were teaching about LGBT rights. There were huge protests in certain parts of the country. And I think it goes back to what you were saying about that difficulty and that challenge in having some of these conversations, but we've got to break through it. And I think the best way to support parents is through knowledge and sharing really openly and really honestly what we're teaching the children, why we're teaching the children that, how we're teaching this challenge, discrimination and difficulty. And any parent who doesn't agree with that then needs to come and meet with the head one-to-one, I would say, because you've got to break down those barriers. And one-to-one always, to me, seems the best way to do it. But gosh, it's hard. It's not easy. And it's a cultural change. It's going to take time for sure.
So we're psyching ourselves up for September, whatever September might bring. Wry laughter from Clemmy. A bit like
I've also got the Rocky theme tune in my head. I'm hearing like duh, 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 duh. Like, I'm so ready. I love
born
that.
Ready.
I'm only laughing because I'm so unready. Like we've written our plan, but now we're waiting for the next set of government guidance, you know, out on the 11th of August. Then what I'm assuming will be another tranche of guidances before we actually get to September. But it goes back to your thing about controlling the controllables, doesn't it? And I think that's got to be the same for everybody, whether it's teachers, whether it's the children themselves, the parents. I think the way we're going to build confidence and get people to feel okay about September is controlling the controllables and making them as watertight as we can, because the thing that will make all of the wheels fall off will be people who are too scared to come back. And that's what we've got to deal with, I think.
I remember you said to me a few weeks ago, everyone expects me to have all of the answers, and being prepared as a school leader, back to that authenticity of being able to say, actually, this is what we do know. This is what we are controlling. These are the things we don't know yet. And as a country, these are the things we don't know yet. So it's actually making people feel as secure as we can. What I found really good with my own kids' schools is, we've got photographs of how the classrooms are going to look, of the one-way systems. We've got clarifications around uniform, that they will be expected to wear full school uniform. So there are certain things that the leadership are giving us and giving our children that we know will be the case where possible.
Yeah. Absolutely. And the way we did it was we had reception 1 and 6 back. We then had 5 back as well. But we also managed to build in the opportunity to have 4, 3, and 2 back for 4 days each. So by the time you broke up, everyone had been back in school because it was all about just getting people back together and being comfortable with being together. And I think, you know, we have to remember when we're looking to September, you know, we're utterly obsessed at the moment with risk assessments, rightly so, but risk assessments and guidance and 2 meters and anti-back and all of these things. But actually at the heart of it are people, either little people who we're teaching or bigger people who we're working with or are trusting us with their little people. And we cannot move away from that focus on people, because that is everything.
So our year 5 daughter had one afternoon back in, two afternoons back in. She had the time of her life. She was so delighted just to be around people again. But let's remember there will be children who are feeling extremely anxious, adults who are feeling extremely anxious about going back. You know, we've got this sensory overload, and just, you know, easing people back in and being understanding of the range of experiences that people have had. You know, this is, you know, this whole in it together was revealed early on to be such complete nonsense. The range of experiences, you know, we cannot assume that every child will have had a paddling pool in their garden for this period. Yeah. We cannot
so
assume
true.
That every child will have had enough food to eat. So we really, yeah, it's a huge challenge, but it's an exciting one.
It is. I think we also need to find the milk of human kindness again. I remember when we first went into lockdown, you know, I don't know about where you are, but in Surbiton, for the first time ever, we were making eye contact with people on the street and we were saying, good afternoon. And it was really quite lovely. And we collapsed the NHS on a Thursday and we were all in it together and painting rainbows and having this deep sense of love and gratitude. And again, I can't speak for the whole country, but it's not happening here anymore, that's for sure. And I think, you know, come September, we need to find that kindness and that compassion and that seeing people as humans first and everything else second, because ultimately that's what distinguishes us from animals and objects, is that humanity, and we need to find it quite quickly. Actually,
humanity over sanitizer, there you go, 3-word. But speaking of humanity, then this is a mantra that I first heard from Mary Myatt. Mary Myatt is an education advisor. She works closely with schools. Her mantra is that there are just no quick fixes, and you know, it's all about the people. It's all about the humanity. Mary started life as a teacher, much like Andy. She's a former Ofsted inspector. I used to call her the White Witch of Ofsted because she always spoke such reason. And we are extremely excited to have caught up with her thoughts on how we can best move forward and make sure we don't go back to how things were. How would you help leaders remain optimistic during this period?
One of the things to do is to think back into events that we've been through in the past and reflect on the fact that we came through them. I think can bolster one's sense of I can do this. And there's a great set of quotes from Rosabeth Moss Kanter, professor at Harvard University. She's got great 6 keys. So the first one is show up to do our work, and that is like in our complete selves, not just physically. Speak up for the things we think are important. Team up. Everything is better when we work more than one. Look up. Remind ourselves of the big reason why we're in this work. Never give up. And she just says everything that is worthwhile, any worthwhile endeavor, there's always going to be a point when it just seems as though, you know, it's not going to work or we're not going to get through it. You never sense success when you're in the middle of something. And she just says, you know, if it is worthwhile, you know, take stock, draw strength, pause, and then push on gently through. And then her last one is lift others up, which I just think is marvelous. I think it's the greatest gift we can give to other people is to encourage other people. And in fact, I've just done a short film voiceover film, just a short 6-minute video on her work, which is one of the short films on my website that I'm just putting up in this time. Not that I've got masses of time, but there is a bit more time. And so I've just been putting up some short films at no charge. And Rosabeth Moscant is one of them, because I just think she's so powerful. So to come back to your point about how do you encourage people who are going through this dreadful time, is that part of it is recognizing simply how frightful it is. However, you know, the whole sector turned on a sixpence within about 48 hours. And I think part of living through this sort of suspended animation at the moment, you know, everyone's still incredibly busy, absolutely exhausted, whether they're in school or not, but for leaders having to manage the uncertainty and for their teams as well, trying to protect them and still be honest, I think it would be helpful to go back and think, well, you know, we did make this happen very, very quickly, and to, you know, give themselves a collective pat on the back that, you know, everyone is still kind of standing and doing the right thing.
I think that the points you've raised there are so important. In fact, we've just recently surveyed all of our children, all of our staff, and all of our parents. And in fact, the survey that had the most negative responses was actually from staff, which I totally understand. But one of the slight criticisms was that we were being a little bit too reactive to the situation. And I think in terms of a global pandemic, you can only really be reactive to the immediate situation. But we now recognise this isn't going to be a flash in the pan and back to normal in September. So if you were leading a school now, Mary, looking to September and beyond, how would you take a more proactive stance? What are those first key steps that you would take to start leading the school forward in a positive, proactive way, do you think?
Two threads to that. One is, I think, the way we cultivate culture. So I think, and then the second one is what we can assume children have or haven't done. So just to touch on culture first, what is absolutely clear, in my mind at any rate, is that there are going to be big stories from every individual that crosses that threshold, and the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I think wise leaders will find a structure of some kind or other, whether it's in tutorial groups, whether it's through a writing program or whatever, where individuals can just clock what's happened to them. And I think if this doesn't happen, I think there will be this sort of lingering sense of a lack of completion, that we're shifting from one domain into another. You know, the disclosure can be as much or as little as any individual wants, and they don't need to do anything. But I think that opportunity to do so, I think, could be very healing, because I think there needs to be a lot of healing that goes on collectively. And I think, you know, you don't spend forever doing this. I think it can be wrapped up reasonably quickly. The kinds of narratives that I'm seeing, I mean, most sensible schools, I mean, this is me saying it's sensible, other people might disagree, is they're focusing on children revisiting what's been taught before, consolidating stuff, because the danger of trying to teach anything new without a human being to mediate that, I just think is nigh on impossible. Yeah. So I don't think it's been worthless putting work out there, but I can't assume that it's gone in the way that I would have wanted to. So I think we've got to be really, really sharp.
We can't assume anything, can we?
They can't assume anything. And it won't just be, you know, for some of our poorer children, you know, there are going to be plenty of middle-class kids or more prosperous backgrounds where they've just been allowed to sort of doss around all day. But they will have learned lots of other things, you know, nature walks and baking bread and all this sort of stuff, which in my view is deeply important. But I think we've then got to be really on the ball about what are the ways that we currently know from research and cognitive science that are going to, you know, get this, get the wheels going again quickly? We cannot afford to faff around once they're back.
There are quite a lot of staff out there who have been exceptionally well treated. You know, there have been some amazingly compassionate leaders who put their staff well-being at the centre of everything they've done. But there are a few, and you alluded to this earlier, who've felt very scrutinised and not particularly supported. If they're not happy in their current context, it does seem that quite a lot are very nervous about moving on during this period. What advice would you give them if they're feeling that actually their suspicions about not feeling particularly well supported have been confirmed during this period?
Scanning the horizon, if they've got the opportunity to do that, because, you know, it's all very well being in a school which is not a great fit. You know, if you're in a city or a large town, that's not the case if yours is the only school and in the vicinity and you'd have a 50-mile round trip. If you know that you could move schools without needing to move your home, which might not matter if you're young and single, but that's not the case for plenty of people, then keep your horizons
that's true.
Open. And I'm a great believer that once you've sort of, this is going to sound so new agey, but once you've put something out into the universe, like I'm looking for this, or I would be interested in this, it's very interesting what you start noticing or what sort of lands in your inbox or someone mentions it to you and it resonates. So I think there's that. And then there's, you know, there are schools recruiting. It's much slower, obviously. And for those for whom it is not possible to change, I think you've got to really work on a support network, whether it's within school or without, so that you are, in a way, cocooned from this and then supported to gather evidence for unreasonable demands, but have people to sort of beef up your spirit and things. And I don't think that should ever be someone at home, because I think anyone who's in a relationship with a teacher and then it all comes out at home is just, it's not fair. It's not fair. We've got to wrap as much of it up as we can, either within school or with our mates, or, you know, do something online. So I so sympathize for people who are in schools which are toxic.
So one of my favourite things that Mary always talks about is how values should be lived, not laminated. I just think that is the most brilliant thing. And I think that is going to be my absolute focus in September, is coming back to the core values of my school and how that will impact me as a leader. We're there to inspire, encourage and empower our children. And that must be the focus. Regardless of what happens, everything else, the children must be at the heart of it. And being that humane leader will certainly be how I aim to lead from September. I'm sure my staff will give me feedback, but that's going to be my plan. What about you? What's your plan for September, Em?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of supporting teachers in schools, it really is about shouting as loudly as possible. We cannot just go back to how we do things around here if how we do things around here is based on a culture of mistrust, of excessive scrutiny, of ridiculous amounts of data and putting the data before the people. So for me, I suppose it's about those mantras that I've repeated over the years, but being more important than ever. For me as well, though, Clem, it's news. I'm quite excited. I'm going back into the classroom in September. It's one day a week, but I think for clarity, I haven't been in the classroom this last academic year. I've been in lots of schools, but I haven't been teaching.
Yeah.
And I'm going back to teach at the pupil referral unit every Friday with children who really, really struggle to be in school each day, because I realised how much I missed that classroom interaction, which sounds cheesy.
Friday's going to be your favourite day. No, it's going to be your favourite day every week.
Friday's going to be my favourite day. So I am. So that's what September brings for me. And that's probably the thing I am most excited about.
That is so exciting. And also, I'm going to be a bit cheesy too now. I have never, ever been more proud of our teachers and our profession. Yeah. And I think Dame Alison Peacock did the most amazing job throughout the summer of just tweeting each day a thank you, a well done. I think our profession has smashed it. And I think we're going to smash it again in September, which is brilliant news, because just this morning I saw a really exciting bit of data showing that numbers of people wanting to come into teaching are really, really high.
Yes.
Clearly, something has happened. Now, I, you know, being ever optimistic, rose-tinted glasses tweeted, oh, this is amazing. So many people want to do this incredible job that we're so privileged to do. And a few people came back and challenged me, which I do always welcome, saying, oh, no, they just want an easier job, or they've heard about the holidays, or they want some stability. And I'm sure that there is an element of that. But I'm going to take the positive and think that they've seen what an incredible job teachers do. They've also seen firsthand through supporting their children's learning what teaching is actually about. And I'm so excited that more people want to come into our profession. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, I must admit, the cynic on my shoulder. See, I've seen this coming for a little while because I've been working with teacher recruitment organisations.
Yeah, of course.
And there is a little cynic on my shoulder which says, actually, well, it is an incredibly stable job and it's one of the few jobs that couldn't and didn't furlough staff and so on and so forth. However, working with new teachers, as I do, which is actually amazing, I love it, speaking to them, the fire in their belly is stronger than ever. You know, one of them said to me the other day, I now know why I wanted to do this. Having sat in front of a frigging computer trying to set lessons to children who aren't there, I now know that being in the classroom is my absolute passion. So let's go with that. So as long as those people are, there are two things, aren't there? You've got to love young people and you've got to love your subject. And if you've got those things, then you've got the raw ingredients to be a really good teacher. And all of the naysayers and doom and gloom can just go and whinge in a corner of the staff room. And we will envelop these people in the most safest distance hugs we can and welcome them into our wonderful profession.
I completely agree. And I think, you know, is it so bad to want a job where there's some stability and there's a future in it? You know, God, I'm going to be really risky here and say, fine, good, let that be a reason. As long as you're going to come in and commit to my children and commit to my school or commit to whichever school you're going to, great. And like you say, that love of what you do will carry you through when it's hard. It's a tough job from time to time, but it's also the best job in the world, without a shadow of a doubt. And I think, you know, let's get those people in, let's show them why it's an amazing job. And even if it wasn't their first choice when they first graduated, fine. Who does still do their first choice job 40 years on? We do chop and change now. Get them in, show them how amazing it is, treat them brilliantly, and then watch them fly, because it's going to be awesome.
Absolutely. And we can be the worst, I say we as a profession, at denigrating our own profession.
Yes.
And actually, it's our job to talk it up, and it's our job to make it a profession worth coming into. So, woohoo!
That could not agree more.
That is the battle cry for the end of this podcast.
Which is just awesome. However, you may have just listened to that and thought, what a load of rubbish. Then tell us, you know, join us, join that conversation, because we do like to be challenged. So, you know, join that conversation and let us know, what are you going to do to make sure our classrooms are filled with people who are passionate about teaching and want to be there? And if they're not, what can you do to help them get them to that point? Because it is so important. But yeah, let's end with the battle cry. It's just been so amazing to sit and talk to you
it's
all
wonderful.
This time. It's been amazing. And to just hear from everyone at home, and it feels like we're back normal. You know, we're back doing things that we were doing before and indeed during lockdown. So thank you so, so much for joining me and spending this time with me. I've loved it.
Oh, it's been wonderful. Then thank you to all our listeners. And please, please, please have a rest. Do not spend your summer reading books about pedagogy. Please don't. You know, do a bit if it makes you happy. You don't need to laminate anything. You don't need to do your displays till the end of the holidays. No. If you've done your displays and you want to tweet about it, that's brilliant as well. But if you read someone who's tweeted about it and imagine everyone else is doing it, they're not. We're mainly sleeping till 10 and being excessively lazy and tending our tomatoes.
Yeah, how are your tomatoes?
Thriving. I have a veritable jungle of vegetables, Clementine. A veritable jungle.
Can we just take a moment for my primary teacher? Are they? I don't know why I was so over the top of patronising about that. I think that's wonderful. I'm not doing myself any favours.
They're gasping for a drink, my vegetables.
Well, go and water them and be proud that you did that. You grew those vegetables. You're so much more than just a revered educational leader, writer, teacher, you know, podcaster. You're also a vegetable grower.
Horticulturalist first. On which note, I am going to go and test out my new sprinkler.
Woo, rock and roll. I'm off to go and read a book. So until then, take care, be well, and I'll speak to you soon. Bye.
Bye.
The Clem & M podcast was presented by Clemmie Stewart and Emma Kell, produced by Ralph Vadgama. The Clem & M podcast was a Those That Can production.